It is Thursday, June 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump blames Democrats for the immigration crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border. White House officials say planning is underway for a summit between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. And we hear about a mother-daughter adventure on top of Tanzania's Mount Kilimanjaro. It's all ahead. First Lady Melania Trump is visiting a child immigration detention center in McAllen, Texas, on the U.S.-Mexico border. Her trip to the area was unannounced a day after President Donald Trump reversed a policy of separating migrant families at the southern border. Mrs. Trump spoke about the reasons for her visit.
We all know they're here without their families. And I want to thank you for your hard work, your compassion, and your kindness you're giving them in these difficult times. I'm here to learn about your facility, and which I know you house children on a long-term basis. And I also like to ask you how I can help to these children to reunite with their families as quickly as possible.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen said there's a plan to reunite the more than 2,000 children who have been detained apart from their parents. Meanwhile, VOA's Eleni Barros at an immigration court hearing in McAllen, Texas, said prosecutors dropped misdemeanor charges against 17 migrants. The migrants who were separated from their children remain detained, but dropping the charges could be a means to reunite them and allow the families to be detained together. Eleni Vera spoke with me about the legal proceeding.
We got to the federal courthouse here in McAllen. We were waiting to, people allowed us to enter and see the hearings and take notes. The gentleman from the Texas Civil Rights Project comes out and says, "We're done for today. The cases have been dismissed." And we said, "Well, what do you mean the cases have been dismissed?" And he says that they're criminal misdemeanor legal entry for 17 families that they were able to speak with were dropped. The prosecutors did not pursue them. And we asked why, and he said that that's the information they had, and the prosecutors don't have to tell them why they did not pursue, but they just dropped the cases.
Is it known then what will happen now? Will they be reunited with their children?
So that's what it's unclear, because the children are under ORR care, right? And the ORR care, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and ICE and DHS, they don't share the same system. So it's unclear yet what's going to happen. We asked this gentleman from the Texas Civil Rights Project, his name is Efren Olivares, and he said that the parents most likely will go back to an immigration detention center, but he does not know and he cannot tell if the children will be taken there, will be reunited with the parents. The job of this gentleman is to speak with the parents who had their children taken away from them, have all their information, and make sure they're keeping tracking of those cases, because otherwise only the U.S. government knows who they separated from who.
Because there have been reports, now I don't know if these children were related to the cases that you're speaking about, there have been reports that some children have been taken as far away as New York City.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Some children, and that's the discretion of the office. I mean, they can literally decide to take the people, everywhere, whatever, whenever there's a space available. This is not a practice that happens with adults. You may be detained in a place like Detroit, for instance, but you may be in a detention center, in an immigration detention center here in Texas, even though you were living in Detroit. So it's not uncommon among adults. It is surprising that this is happening also with children.
Well, meanwhile, are migrants continuing to try to come into the United States?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the 17 people that the Texas Civil Rights Project interviewed today were detained on Monday and Tuesday, this past Monday and Tuesday. So, you know, and the gentleman, Olivares, actually told us, even though our work is done here for today, we'll be back tomorrow and we'll continue to come back tomorrow. But the people that they interviewed today to get their information and to get the children's information try to cross the country Monday and Tuesday.
VOA's Eleni Barras reporting from McAllen, Texas. Well, the moves come as the House of Representatives prepares to vote Thursday on a pair of immigration bills that address the separations, as well as other issues that have divided the country's major political parties. In a tweet Thursday, President Trump expressed skepticism that any House immigration bill could get the necessary votes, blaming Democrats. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Pakistan confirms a U.S. drone killed a militant leader. Russian news agency reports that Russian President Putin discusses a peace pact with his Ukrainian counterpart. Sources say the Trump administration plans to unveil, to merge the education and labor departments. And Pope Francis seeks Christian unity in Geneva. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Over the years, scientists gathered enough evidence to prove the existence of either small-sized or supermassive types of black holes. But what about black holes that are in between those sizes, intermediate mass black holes? Until now, detection of these medium-sized black holes have proven to be quite elusive. Researchers at the University of New Hampshire say they have found the strongest evidence so far that intermediate mass black holes do exist. Analyzing the combined data gathered by three X-ray space telescopes, the researchers were able to capture a medium mass black hole as it was consuming a star that wandered too close to it. Researchers say their discovery suggests that there are many of these intermediate mass black holes quietly lurking in a dormant state across the local universe. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the United Nations sees the U.S. withdrawal from the U.N. Human Rights Council as uncharted territory. We'll have a report. White House officials are indicating that planning is underway for a summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Media reports quote unnamed sources who say the meeting is expected to take place next month during Trump's visit to Europe. Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow tells me about what is known in the Russian capital concerning the summit.
Well, this has been something that's been rumored now for quite some time, Sarah. What we do know for a fact, this has been confirmed today by the presidential spokesman of Vladimir Putin. This is a guy named Dmitry Peskov. He said that they weren't going to comment on the details of these talks, but he did confirm that U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton would likely head to Russia next week. It's assumed that Bolton would be here, in fact, to try and iron out the details of this proposed summit. The idea that it should be timed sometime next month. Basically, the question is whether it happens before the NATO summit in Brussels on July 11th or after Trump's visit to Britain on July 13th. So that's really the key thing here, is if they can iron out the what and the when. Observers, however, have other questions about what exactly they'll be talking about, these two leaders.
Yes, certainly. Thinking about the number of items that could be on the agenda between these two leaders.
Right. The items, the list is long. I mean, whether we're talking about the simmering proxy war between Russia and Ukraine in Ukraine's east, that's one issue, of course. We've got the war in Syria. We've got election interference or alleged election interference by the Russian government in the U.S. presidential election in 2016. These, of course, being the ones that Donald Trump won to become the president of the United States. But, you know, beyond that, it's just, you know, in terms of kind of diplomatic language and diplomatic timeframes, the idea of basically under a month to try and put something like this together on the presidential level is kind of unheard of. It seems to be that Mr. Trump, having come back from Singapore, where he met with Kim Jong-un from North Korea, felt as though that was a success. It was also kind of a shotgun wedding, as it were, between, or a shotgun summit between leaders. And he now wants to try the same thing with the Russian president. And it's worth noting that probably in Washington, and certainly within his White House, he's almost the only one who seems to really want this meeting with Vladimir Putin.
What would Russia seek to gain in talks? I mean, apparently Trump is perceived by some as that he wants to restore Putin's standing on the global stage, which was diminished following the Russian invasion of Crimea.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, the Russians have several things that are of interest to them. Of course, they have this ongoing conflict. They're involved in the military intervention in Syria, and I think they're very interested in getting American troops out of the way. So essentially making sure that there's deconfliction between American forces and Russian forces operating on the ground in Syria. And I think there's probably some room for that. Generally, the Russians and the Russian government has often expressed its willingness to work with the U.S. on terrorism issues. Certainly, cyber threats is another one that they're always likely to bring up. But in terms of what they'd really like, which is the cancellation of Western sanctions, that's simply off the table at this point, because the U.S. Senate and the U.S. Congress has passed laws that make it so that President Trump cannot reduce these sanctions that are levied against Russia over its alleged interference in these presidential elections in 2016 in the U.S. So there's only so much that Donald Trump can do. On the other hand, I think some people look at it and say, look, it's something of a fixation here in Moscow, that if these two leaders could finally just meet face-to-face, not one of these kind of very quick sideline meetings that we've seen over the last year, but actually have a real sit-down and a formal summit meeting, then that perhaps they could just develop some kind of relationship that would reduce tensions at the very least, and it could make some progress there and something to build on. That's really the hope here.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. The United Nations has begun the process of filling the seat left vacant by the United States at the UN Human Rights Council now that Washington has formally notified the UN it's resigning from the 47-member body. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN body wasted no time adjusting to the new reality. It already has removed the U.S. nameplate from the area where the 47 members of the Human Rights Council sit and has placed it among the observer states. Council spokesperson Rolando Gomez tells VOA the seat eventually will be filled by a new member elected by the General Assembly.
This is new, uncharted territory. This is something never happened before where a member of the council has withdrawn its membership, so we are moving the best way we can and following the proper procedures.
Council members are elected from five regional groups: the African, Asian, Eastern European, Latin American and Caribbean, and Western groups. Gomez says the U.S. vacancy will be filled by a country from the Western group, including Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and Israel.
In theory, yes, Israel could assume membership as they are members of the Western group. Any state within the Western group has potential to fulfill that vacancy.
The irony of such an outcome is not lost on observers, considering that Washington blames what it calls the hypocrisy of the UN Council and its chronic bias against Israel for its decision to quit the Council. Gomez says the United States can continue to participate and play an influential role as an observer state. He says it is their prerogative to engage or disengage.
The key difference between a member and observer is members can vote and observers can't. The United States would be able to sponsor resolutions, hold side events, influence language and resolutions. The key difference is they wouldn't be able to vote.
While the United States can continue to exert immense influence as an observer, Gomez notes it is always better to be part of the equation than to be on the sidelines watching. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Pro-government coalition forces backed by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have secured the airport of the Red Sea port city of Hodeida, dealing a setback to the Houthi rebel defenders who have controlled that vital port since 2014. Hundreds have reportedly been killed in clashes since coalition forces launched their assault a week ago. The fighting is seen as a way to break the stalemate in the three-year conflict. but it also raises the specter of yet another major humanitarian crisis in the impoverished Gulf state. Some 600,000 people are believed affected by the battle. The rebels have vowed to fight on. Hodeidah is strategic to both sides. It's the entry point for most supplies and humanitarian aid flowing into Yemen. Salim al-Shamiri has been the Hodeidah office coordinator for the Norwegian Refugee Council. He had to leave the city for the relative safety of the rebel-held Yemeni capital, Sana'a. He spoke from there with International Edition's Victor Beatty.
Most of the people who have financial resources have left the city. To Sana'a and to other given rate, like Hajja.
What are the conditions in Hodeidah? Hello? I understand the water supply may have been cut.
Yes, some areas in Hodeidah, the water supplies were cut. This is one of our big concerns, and I have talked about this when the escalation started. It seems that authority will not be able to push or to pump some water. So people, they cannot afford to live there in Hodeidah without water resources.
And there's also a problem of people fleeing from bombing campaigns going on.
Yes. Yesterday, there were people who were displaced from the south of Hodeidah to the north. They were staying in schools. But yesterday, they had to leave to Sana'a and other locations, safe location for them. Hodeidah is one of the biggest governorate that needs an urgent humanitarian needs. I don't know if you have heard about those reports that Hodeidah needs a quick food assistance, and the cholera outbreak there in Hodeidah is really spread, as well as the malnutrition is very high among children and women in Hodeidah.
So Hodeidah is a vital port city. The Houthis have lost, apparently, control of the airport in Hodeidah to the coalition forces, but they vowed to fight on. Is this going to be a long battle?
I don't know about this, but it seems that seaport is really important, not for Houthis or for the coalition, it's for the all Yemeni. The seaport, receive 70% of food and fuel supplies. Because it's the second largest seaport in the Yemen, as well as it is the safest and quickest and the cheapest seaport to deliver food assistance or goods in general, fuel, to the whole country.
Salim, if the port should fall to coalition forces, will that be a turning point in the conflict there?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the people there in Hodeidah, they are really suffering. Most of them, or thousands of innocent people, they don't have the financial resources to evacuate from Hodeidah or to be displaced to other location. So one of our big concerns that they're stuck in the middle of the clashes and escalation there in Hodeidah. So we really want to have like safe routes for people, so in order for them to leave the city if they could.
Salim al-Shamiri, the Hodeidah office coordinator for the Norwegian Refugee Council. This is International Edition. At an age when most kids were mastering the skills like math and reading, 7-year-old Montana Kenny was becoming the youngest girl to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. She summited Africa's highest peak with her mother over her spring break from school this March. Faiza Al-Masri caught up with Montana and her mother, Holly Kenny, and has their story narrated by Faith Lapidus.
At 5,895 meters, Mount Kilimanjaro is one of the highest peaks in the world. Reaching the summit was quite an adventure for 7-year-old Montana Kenny of Austin, Texas. The quest started about 2 years ago when her mother, Holly Kenny, decided to climb the mountain in Tanzania.
My sister had asked me if I was interested in climbing Mount Kilimanjaro with her, and when we started the planning phase, she had backed out of it, and she decided she didn't want to go anymore. And then I had been asking a couple friends if they were interested in going, and Montana chimed in. She said, "I want to do it with you, Mommy."
Montana wanted to set a new record and, more importantly, pay tribute to her father, who'd passed away when she was 3.
I knew that heaven was not that much farther up from Mount Kilimanjaro, so I wanted to do it.
It took 6 days to reach the peak.
It was pretty warm at the bottom, but it was pretty cold at the very, very, very top.
Montana's mother says it took months for them to get ready for the trip.
I'm an endurance athlete, so it wasn't foreign to me to do something like this. And both of us are swimmers, so she was in good shape to begin with, and she's also a triathlete. We started doing a lot of back-to-back hiking. So fortunately, in the Austin, Texas area, we've got a couple big hills that we could go up and down and up and down to get our hip flexors and muscles ready for the bigger challenge.
Getting ready for the big challenge also meant packing appropriate clothing, researching the mountain and Tanzania, and worrying about altitude sickness.
Yeah, I definitely had a lot of anxiety about altitude sickness. I did not want to risk my daughter. I didn't want her to be at risk. And what they kept saying was everybody gets altitude sickness.
That's a combination of symptoms ranging from headache, dizziness, and nausea to loss of energy and shortness of breath triggered by the decrease of oxygen at high altitudes.
We had made the decision that even if she showed the slightest sign of altitude sickness, we were going to turn around. We were not going to go. So I was almost certain we weren't going to make it, but we did, and my daughter didn't have any issues.
But mother and daughter were nervous the night before their guide was to help them reach the summit.
We didn't get any sleep. That was very challenging because she just wanted to lay down and go to sleep. And then to take 7.5 hours to reach the summit. And then when we finally get there, we have to come back down, which was another 3 hours. And then we had lunch and then spent another 5.5 hours going down even further. So it was 17 hours total that we were hiking. It was extremely exciting. And to see Montana blow kisses to her daddy and to know that she was as close as she possibly could be to him in heaven, that was really just something that was very meaningful for a mom to see.
In addition to the accomplishment of reaching the top of Kilimanjaro and setting a world record, the trip was an introduction to new cultures.
Not only did we try different foods when we were on the mountain, but we went on 2 safaris. We stopped in one of the towns to see how the people in Tanzania live. And we went to their local markets. We met several business owners. We met several families. And that was really exciting. And the kids that lived in the towns absolutely loved meeting my daughter. That was a lot of fun.
And Montana learned that with determination and hard work, she can achieve whatever she sets her mind to. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the recent NATO defense ministerial, Secretary of Defense James Mattis observed that threats to our collective security have not waned, whether terrorism to the south or Russia's aggression and hybrid threats to the east. Burden sharing among alliance members has improved since 2014, when only 3 nations' military spending was at 2% of GDP, noted Secretary Mattis. Last year saw the largest across NATO increase in military spending in a quarter century. In 2018, 8 nations are already meeting the 2% pledge benchmark, and more are on track to reach 2% by 2024. In the global fight against ISIS, Secretary Mattis said, we will continue to carry out operations necessary to crush the physical caliphate and prevent a resurgence of ISIS-Daesh. We will be unrelenting in our effort. Working with like-minded nations, we will target ISIS around the world, for this remains a global fight. To support these efforts, NATO is transitioning its current activity in Iraq into a sustainable non-combat training mission. In concert with the new Iraqi government, NATO will capitalize on Iraq's success and reinforce their long-term counterterrorism efforts. In Afghanistan, the security forces continue to improve, said Secretary Mattis. All 6 Afghan corps are deployed throughout the country, demonstrating Afghan resolve, while the Afghan government pursues a stable and inclusive political order for its people with NATO's support. For nearly 70 years, the NATO alliance has served to uphold the values and the principles on which our democracies were founded, said Secretary Mattis. The American people remain committed to this alliance, and we look forward to working together to sustain our core function, which is the collective defense of our people while fostering peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.